As many as 95 planes were landing at O'Hare each hour when the FAA decided to take action. The limit now for peak periods is 80, a goal that will be met by delaying flights at their point of departure to make sure they don't all get to O'Hare at once. That's already caused some delays, and a quick survey of passengers at O'Hare indicates those delays are as much a concern as is the issue of safety.
I fly on an airline that has a major hub here. And I have seldom encountered any serious delays. Mm-hmm. So while it concerns me, at the same time, I haven't had any problem. So it hasn't been a major worry so far.
But others take note of the FAA's report on air traffic controller errors. 30 so far this year, including a string this past week of 5 errors in 5 days. The National Transportation Safety Board has called on the FAA to increase the number of controllers at the O'Hare Center, which serves the area's many smaller airports as well. One NTSB official compared a crew walking off a shift at the O'Hare Tower to dazed-looking soldiers he remembers after combat in Vietnam. In light of that assessment, frequent O'Hare traveler Kate Krebs suggests the new cutback on the number of flights may be too little, too late.
To me, it's poor planning, because there are a number of other hub airports around here, like Mitchell Field in Milwaukee, for example, that years ago we could have been diverting more flights into there.
Passengers aren't the only ones still concerned about safety at O'Hare. Pilots, when granted anonymity, freely discuss the potential problems with O'Hare's high traffic volume and overworked controller staff.
I'm very concerned about it. I'm very concerned about air safety. I think it's become too congested, considering that we have outdated equipment, we have a shortage of controllers, and a shortage of experienced controllers.
It's getting to the point where we'd practically saturated to danger levels.
Controllers themselves are reluctant to talk about their work conditions, but those who do talk seem surprised to learn the FAA has taken any action at all to ease their workload.
I didn't know they cut any bags.
You haven't noticed a difference?
No.
I really don't notice that much difference, really. You know, you just get a lot of airplanes, you know, and they all come at the same time, usually, and you know, they're not stressed out through the hour. It's like when they say they have 80 arrivals an hour. Well, they might happen in like maybe a 30 or 45 minute period. It's not our fault. It's just the airlines. You know, that's the way they schedule them, you know, and it's business, you know.
Would you fly in and out of O'Hare?
I never fly. I always take the train.
FAA officials do say that if their current rescheduling plan doesn't work, they'll modify it, looking for better ways to ease the traffic crunch at O'Hare Airport. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Post intro. To commemorate the 100th anniversary this Sunday, October 16th, of the birth of American playwright Eugene O'Neill, a Chicago theater company is reviving two of O'Neill's one-act plays. The Gare Saint-Lazare Players' production of Before Breakfast and Huey strips O'Neill to his essence, spotlighting the man's words in a way they may never have been presented before. Marge Halperin reports. In what's become the trademark of the Gare Saint-Lazare Players, both Before Breakfast and Huey are presented as monologues, though they were written for and traditionally are presented with two characters. This time it's just one actor, the audience, and the power of O'Neill's words. Before Breakfast, the 10-minute diatribe of a shrewish wife, was meant to be performed with both wife and husband on stage. At one time, O'Neill played the husband himself. In this production, actress Cynthia Caponera sits alone on stage, talking to a husband who is never seen and never heard.
Alfred, Alfred, you needn't pretend you're asleep. Alfred, Alfred, I knew it. Alfred, Alfred, don't you think it's about time you got up? Do you want to stay in bed all day? Not that I've got any doubts about your being lazy enough to stay in bed forever.
The rhythm of those words focuses attention on them. The audience can't ignore this lecture as one ignores a tirade heard 100 times before. Director Bob Meyer says he rejected O'Neill's own elaborate stage directions to let those words shine through.
Just wishing O'Neill was around so he could see what how we really screwed this thing up, to see what he was going to say about it.
What do you think he would say?
Of course, I think he would say, wow, this is really great, but he probably wouldn't give us the rights. You know, he wrote stage directions in this thing that were as long as the play. And before giving it to the actors and everything, we just cut it out. We cut everything out, literally cut it out. I think O'Neill was a great writer, but I think he was a terrible, 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 terrible director.
It's hard to imagine that O'Neill wouldn't be pleased to see this purified version of his own work. It might have been a pleasant surprise for him, as it is for the audience, to find Huey staged not as a dialogue between a hotel night clerk and his two-bit hustler tenant, but as a heartfelt monologue by the tenant, who mourns the death of a former hotel employee. Here, Erie Smith is played by the director, Bob Meyer, and the audience serves as the night clerk.
Key. I forgot, you ain't seen me before. Erie Smith's the name. I'm an old-timer in this flea bag. 492. How long you been on the job? 4 or 5 days, huh? Yeah, I've been off on a drunk. I come to now, though. I'm tapering off. Well, I'm glad they fired the young squirt they took on when Huey got sick. One of them fresh, wise punks couldn't tell him nothing. Pleased to meet you. Hope you stick around. What's your name? Hughes. Charlie Hughes. Hughes. Charlie Hughes. I'll be damned. What the hell you know about that? Say, now I notice you don't look like Huey, but you remind me of him somehow. You ain't by any chance related. No, relations. That's right. Huey told me he didn't have no relations left, except his wife. Kids, of course. Yeah, the poor guy croaked last week.
What is it about the story that made you think it had to be trimmed so much, that you had to dump the night clerk and get down to the words? Explain that a little
bit. Well, I really didn't want the audience to escape, you know, the way they can through the night clerk. So we decided to just face the audience, and what they get then is part of it. They're part of it. It's a pretty intense deal if you want to work with it. If you don't, you know, you sit in the back and say, yeah, O'Neill's a great writer. But if you really want to work with it, what you see up there is your uncle, the guy on the bus stop, you, all the stuff that I think O'Neill was writing about.
Despite the fact that he trimmed this production to a monologue, Meyer discovered he had three actors in his troupe who seemed to belong in this play. So he signed up two others to alternate with himself, performing the same role on different nights in strikingly different ways. Jim Ortlieb says the key to his portrayal is a decision to remain almost motionless, as his version of Erie Smith conjures up an image of an uncomfortable dinner with night clerk Huey and his wife.
Well, the hell with it. She had me tagged for a bum, and seeing me made her sure she was right. And you can bet she told you he'd never invite me again, and he never did. He tried to apologize, but I shut him up quick. He says, Irma was brought up strict. She can't help being narrow-minded about gamblers. I said, what's it to me? I don't want to hear your dame troubles. I got plenty of my own. Remember that doll I brung in here night before last? She gives me an argument. I promised her $10. I said, listen, baby, I got an impediment in my speech. Maybe it sounded like 10, but it was 2, and that's all you get. Hell, I don't want to buy your soul. What would I do with it? Now, she's peddling the news along Broadway. I'm a rat and a chiseler. And of course, all the rats and chiselers believe it. Before she's through, I won't have a friend left. I switch the subjects on you, you see? On purpose. He never did beef to me about his wife again. Believe me, I can stop guys that start telling me they have family troubles. Jesus, this sure is a dead dump, about as homey as the morgue.
Actor Bob Cohut plays Erie Smith as more hyper, a man too unsure of himself to stand still.
Well, to hell with it. She had me tagged for a bum, and seeing me made her sure she was right. You can bet she told Huey never invite me again, and he never did. Oh, he tried to apologize, but I shut him up quick. He says, Irma was brought up strict. She can't help being narrow-minded about gamblers. I said, what's it to me? I don't want to hear your dame troubles. I got plenty of my own. Remember that doll I brung home night before last? She gives me an argument. I promised her $10. I told her, listen, baby, I got an impediment in my speech. Maybe it sounded like 10, but it was 2, and that's all you get. Hell, I don't want to buy your soul. What would I do with it? Now she's peddling the news along Broadway. I'm a rat and a chiseler, and of course all the rats and chiselers believe her. Before she's through, I won't have a friend left. I switched the subjects on Huey, see? On purpose! He never did beef to me about his wife again. Believe me, I can sure stop guys that start telling me their family troubles. Jesus, this sure is a dead dump. About as homey as the morgue.
No matter who is on stage, director Bob Meyer says this show often surprises the audience. Many promise to dust off their high school copies of O'Neill.
You know, guys our age, like 40 years old. Been brought up with O'Neill, never really went to him, except in school. Then we come out and we say, ooh, I'm going to read O'Neill. This guy was really hot. It's a great play. The poetry's there, and it's really nice to show our American Shakespeare. I mean, it's our guy.
In the program's director's notes, Bob Meyer insists he doesn't mean to reduce all of his productions to a single person on a bare stage, but that's how most of them turn out. It's the process, he says, of putting the magnifying glass on the thing and focusing it in and holding it. O'Neill's extensive staging notes suggest he may have been afraid of that process, but the Gare St. Lazare production of Before Breakfast and Huey makes it clear he had nothing to fear. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago.
I see my character as so unsure of himself, I don't very rarely stay in the same spot. But I don't think I'm moving around so much as Bob described himself as kind of jive moving. I'm moving around because if I stand still, these people are going to hit me and see me for what I am.
Quick, name three children's films. Chances are you included a couple of old Disney classics and perhaps one of the popular commercial characters like Care Bears in Wonderland or She-Ra. But there is a vast selection of children's films being made around the world with the same standards applied to adult films, movies with thoughtful plots and realistic human characters. As Marge Halpern reports, over 100 of those films are being screened in Chicago this week at the 5th Annual Chicago International Children's Film Festival. You might call them art films for the under 16 set. They run the gamut from adventure to animation. Please don't call them cartoons. Virtually every type except educational films. A jury of 11 children and 6 adults rejected those, deciding this festival is strictly for entertainment. What all of the films in the festival have in common is quality, defined by 12-year-old juror Sasha Horn as exactly the same thing adults expect from their films.
I look at the acting. And I look at the plot. The thing these days, I've noticed is that violence and, you know, horror are the in thing these days. And I'd say that if you're going to make a film for children, that you should really, really think it out. Or else it's not going to get good responses at all.
One of Sasha's favorite films is Soldier Jack, the latest in director Tom Davenport's series of the Appalachian Jack Tales, told by the Brothers Grimm. This is the story of a young soldier who mixes bravery, cleverness, and special gifts from a beggar to survive the night in a haunted house. Sasha says he likes the surprise elements in the story, including the appearance of three ghoulish devils and the unexpected ending, where Jack captures death in a sack. And everyone doesn't live happily ever after.
Howdy do, ma'am.
Howdy do, son.
How are you getting along, Granny?
Yeah.
I say, how are you getting along?
Oh, Lord, son, it's awful.
What's awful?
206 years old, that's what's the matter. Ain't you heard? Some blame fools tied death up in a sack. Ain't nobody died around here for 150 years. Now that ain't natural, is it?
These are the big issues of human beings from time immemorial. What's the meaning of life, meaning of death? Why do people die? All those kind of questions.
Soldier Jack director Tom Davenport.
And we think that children can't handle them. Rather than have faith in their ability to say, look, this is a wonderful, important issue, they can deal with it, and here's a film that deals with it, let them see and make their own minds up.
His credits include an Appalachian version of Hansel and Gretel, Rapunzel set at the turn of the century, and The Frog King with a wealthy industrialist as king. Yet director Davenport insists he doesn't make children's films.
It's really nice that I have this children's audience and can find that kind of niche as an independent filmmaker, but I really don't, for example, consult with people now, is this right for children or is it isn't right for children? I don't ever operate like that. I basically say, is this true to the tale or true to myself as a filmmaker? And it's something that I'd like to see. Children respond to that.
They also respond to the films of Canadian Michael Rubeau. He does claim to be a children's filmmaker, drawing a distinction between films about children and those for children.
The ones about children try to have a faithful picture of how children are in the world and how they're treated by adults and how adults' problems slap them in the face, whereas films for children have a fantastic element in the sense that they deal with children's power fantasies. Children feel very powerless in the world, and what they love to see in a story is they themselves taking control and doing things behind adults' backs and reaching decisions and taking risks.
Rubeau's entry in this year's Chicago Festival is Tommy Tricker and the Stamp Traveler, an imaginative story of children who figure out how to make themselves small enough to hitch a ride on a postage stamp. To see whether his plot was believable, Rubeau told his story in schools, asking kids to embellish and correct his version. It was an especially effective technique when Rubeau was in China preparing a travel segment of Tommy Tricker.
They broke up into groups of about six. There were 50 in the class, and they went off into another room, and there was tremendous excitement. I was watching them babbling like sporting teams planning football plays or something, heads all together huddled and fingers flashing and people contradicting each other. And then after about half an hour, they came back, and each group formally presented their plot one after another in front of the class, with me furiously taking notes. And the whole emphasis on magic, the dragon, the lake, all of that comes from the Chinese children.
Ralph? Ralph? Wake up, Ralph? Oh, Ralph, please wake up. Ralph, you have passed the test.
What test?
The test of courage. That's very good. But now the dragon is waiting for us, so let's hurry, okay? Quick, Ralph.
Dear Nancy, last night, I jumped into a lake full of dragons. No, really. I just passed some test of courage. I didn't even know I was passing. These Chinese kids have some strange ideas.
That attention to detail, to believability, isn't unusual for filmmakers, but it may be for makers of children's films. And that's why those who attend this festival are often surprised at the quality of children's movies that are available, but not often well publicized. Many of the films shown here are on video and distributed to classrooms and public libraries. Only a few will make it to commercial theaters. But festival coordinator Susan Delson says these films set a standard for judging any children's film, which she defines not as a movie for kids, but as family fare.
We have films that parents can take their children to, can watch and enjoy together, and can actually serve as the basis of a discussion when they go home, which is very unusual. I mean, what do you talk about? Miami Vice? Do you talk about She-Ra, you know? I think we have a number of filmmakers in the festival this year who are really world-class and mature talents and who are not using children's film as a training ground or a dumping ground, for that matter.
Some of the best family films, Delson says, are hidden on the video store shelves, sandwiched in between Rainbow Bright and Gem. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Host intro. It's an annual problem. If you buy your jack-o'-lantern pumpkin too early, it'll wilt before Halloween. But this year, if you wait too long, you might not find a pumpkin at all. While the meaty pie pumpkins are in good supply this year, Marge Halperin reports this summer's drought has put a big dent in the Midwest crop of decorative pumpkins.
I want one like that.
Well, that's a cute one. Yeah. You don't like that? Hey, I hear you.
This family is shopping for pumpkins at a street-side stand in Chicago. They're pawing through tiny pumpkins and larger but deformed specimens, the hallmark of this year's crop in the Midwest, where the drought was most devastating. For many families, it's taking longer than usual to find just the right jack-o'-lantern material. Pumpkin stand owner Verl Lessig says it wasn't easy for him to find pumpkins this year either.
Yes, I had a lot of trouble to even locate pumpkins. I had to spent about 3 days on the phone. I finally ended up locating some down in Huntington, Indiana, and the price is about three times higher than it was last year.
And so you're selling them for a lot more too, I suppose. How do they compare to last year's prices?
Well, it's probably 2 to 3 times higher than last year.
Lessig's now selling pumpkins for 35 cents a pound, but that didn't scare Delaine Bailey away. Like most pumpkin shoppers, she can't imagine a Halloween without a jack-o'-lantern.
Whatever the price, I have to pay it. Okay, so my daughter's going to be, like, upset if I don't get it anyway. So, you know, it's not a lot to pay. And then you can take them and cook your pumpkin seeds and have pumpkin pie and make the face and everybody's happy. You know, so it's worth it. It's worth it. 4.5 pounds.
That's 30 pounds altogether.
When Bailey found her three pumpkins would cost a total of $10.50, she put one back. It's the ultimate consequence of a problem Midwest pumpkin farmers have known about since August, when a long string of dry 100-degree days sent blossoms tumbling from their stems. John Relicky, whose Granite City, Illinois farm includes 50 acres of decorative pumpkins, says he harvested barely half his usual size crop.
Smaller, the average size is down. There's a lot of disformity in the pumpkins. Everybody likes to have a pumpkin that stands up straight and perfect, and we're having an awful lot of disformity in them.
Relicky says the one bright spot in his ledger book this fall comes from a new marketing trick, the surprisingly popular ugly pumpkin pile at his roadside retail stand.
We kind of got the idea from another grower on television. He felt like that goes with Halloween and ugly faces and everything, so he just he sold them that way and kind of made a gimmick out of it. And they move pretty good like that.
As every child knows, and many adults can remember, it's not really the size or shape that makes a jack-o'-lantern special. It's the fact that you pick it out yourself and carve it in your own inimitable style. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
You're going to carry it all the way back home? How about be logical? Get something like that. That little. Like what? Little one.
Here's the last track in the clear. As every child knows, and many adults can remember, it's not really the size or shape that makes a jack-o'-lantern special. It's the fact that you pick it out yourself and carve it in your own inimitable style. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. Chicago's city council chambers have been the scene of wild debates in recent years. Aldermen have been known to jump on tabletops to make their points. More than once, guards have had to duck flying fists to separate angry debaters. And quite often, the language heard in the chambers is as rough as any heard on the street. But the council may now draw the line at racial slurs and ethnic or gender-related insults, seeking to add a touch of decorum to its raucous debates. Marge Halperin reports. Chicago City Council was in fine form last month when debating a human rights ordinance which called for an end to discrimination against the elderly, handicapped, and most controversial, homosexuals. It was that group that Alderman George Hagopian was addressing when he argued against the bill.
Homosexual activity is known to be characterized by the most dangerous of sanitary practices. The right to spread... Go ahead, animals. You're only entered by the grace of this council.
I said, if you're acting like animals, and they were hooting and hollering, trying to stop me down, I turned around to everybody. That was not meant for any single person. Anybody, for what side, pro or con, that was hissing, hooting, and hollering. I said, animals, keep it up. And the ones that kept it up, they must have been animals because they kept it up.
Alderman Hagopian says he was calling people in the gallery animals because of their heckling, but many of the hecklers were gay. Gay bar owner Dem Hopkins thinks there was more to the reference than that. His bar was firebombed 2 weeks later.
This kind of name-calling and the horrible things that have been said about the gay-lesbian community, it puts it in people's minds that this is not such a bad thing to do. It gives people that extra incentive that it almost like it's okay, that we are less than human. So go ahead and throw a firebomb. It's not that big a deal.
To send a message that such discrimination is not okay, the council is set to vote tomorrow on a non-binding resolution advising aldermen to stop racial, ethnic, and gender-related slurs. Alderman Kathy Osterman sponsored the proposal, thinking not only of raucous council debates, but also of the quieter, but in her mind, just as serious line of questioning that often greets nominees to various city posts.
Women, for example, are said, oh, you're a beautiful woman. Are you married? People are continually asked if they're good Christians. A man had the last name of Haddad, was a professor from Northwestern University who was being considered for the police board. and he was questioned about his last name. What kind of a last name do you have? It's a funny last name.
One who often asked that type of question is Alderman Robert Shaw.
I think when you become an alderman, you don't lose your First Amendment rights. Those rights stay intact. And I think every member of the city council should have that right to ask a question. I have my first time to ask any ethnic questions other than how an individual may relate to blacks. If that person has been a member of the Ku Klux Klan, definitely I don't want to vote for him. If that person is a Nazi, I don't want to vote for him. And I think to try and limit that the line of questioning of an alderman is unconscionable.
Alderman Shaw can continue to pursue his line of questioning even if this proposal wins council approval tomorrow, since the resolution is not a binding law. But sponsor Osterman is hoping it will give her colleagues pause, steering them toward more reserved council debate.
It's guiding. It's not a law. I mean, how can you say you're going to have a law governing how someone behaves? This is a resolution which simply is suggesting in a very strong way, but certainly one that's getting to the point that aldermen need to conduct debate and questioning in a proper manner and not offend people.
The proposal stands a good chance of passing unless Osterman follows through with plans to modify it to limit slurs against homosexuals as well as other minorities. If she does that, Alderman Hagopian vows he'll do all he can to defeat the measure. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
The host intro. So you think you know Romeo and Juliet or Wagner's Tannhäuser? Take another look. These classics are the latest in a long line of old favorites to be updated. Tannhäuser is just wrapping up its run at Chicago's Lyric Opera. Romeo and Juliet is the latest production of that city's Goodman Theater. Marge Halperin explains the new twist on these familiar stories. Convinced that even those who performed Tannhäuser in the past didn't understand its weighty story of a medieval monk tempted by the goddess Venus, director Peter Sellers has given his Chicago cast and audience a version they can surely hook into. His Tannhäuser is a televangelist, modeled after Jimmy Swaggart. Gone are the velveteen robes, harps, and watercolor sets. Trapping Sellers swears helped him fall asleep every time he attempted to sit through a classical staging of the German opera.
The Venus scene is particularly hilarious. It features extremely ample soprano swathed in various layers of diaphanous hoo-ha, and of course the Met Ballet prancing about.
What's your Venus scene like?
Well, we start in something that could be the motel room. There are all these teenage girls running through the halls and giggling, you know, like every motel you've ever stayed at. And Tannhäuser keeps waking up in the middle of this, and he keeps thinking, imagining them in their bathing suits. They're probably by the horrible little pool. And then we see Venus, who is a very, you know, sad middle-aged prostitute. This is probably the biggest fish she's ever caught. And he kind of wants to leave, but she doesn't want to let him go. And yet she doesn't know how to make him happy, because as at least... her testimony in the Swaggart situation, apparently he never laid hands on her.
This story, Sellers says, is one his audience can relate to, one that goes beyond a concert in costume to pull the audience into the emotional depths of the characters on stage. That's his goal with Tannhäuser, and also the goal he sought when he staged The Marriage of Figaro in Trump Tower and set the Mikado in a Datsun factory.
I've never done anything that's not set in the 20th century because it's the only century I know, and it's the only century I've lived in. And again, it's the only way I can testify to the authenticity of what is taking place on stage. You know, none of us ever wore a powdered wig and had lace sleeves coming out of our waistcoat. You know, we just don't know what it would be like to wear those shoes because we never lived in those shoes. Those who are interested in a period piece are perfectly free to imagine it. And in the meantime, the rest of us don't have to creep around the back door. We can enter the front door.
Picture Romeo and Juliet in the classic doublets and tights version. Now envision it set in an American Little Italy in the early 1900s. That's the way director Michael Maggio imagined it, and he's now staging it that way at Chicago's Goodman Theater.
I had the experience recently of going to see Peter Sellers' Tannhauser, and I felt that that lived for me in a very vivid way because of the modern dress setting that he gave that. And I know that if I would try to direct Romeo and Juliet with everybody running around in tights and doublets, I as an artist could not really make a strong enough connection to it to make it work. And I don't think my audience would make really the kind of connection that I want them to make.
Imagining life in period costumes may well be a block for the actors as well as for the audience. Michael Cerveris plays Romeo in this updated Goodman play, and he's also played the traditional Romeo. He says contemporary clothing seems to better fit the rough-and-tumble Romeo he's always portrayed, though he admits the more modern setting of Little Italy can sometimes throw his dialogue off track.
I'll go along, no such sight to be shown, but to rejoice in splendor of mine own. Sometimes comes out, because it's set in the cafe scene, and because that scene, more than a lot of them, seems to feel very Italian and, you know, kind of, I'll go along, no such sight to be shown, but to rejoice in splendor of mine own, you know, and which is, gets the flavor of the place, but, you know, it's a little too casual and contemporary and a little Jewish, I think, actually, in Italian.
The all-seeing sun now saw her equal since first the world begun. You saw her fair, none else being by, herself poised with herself in either eye. But in that crystal scales, let there be weighed your lady love against some other maid that I shall show you shining at this feast. And she shall scan so well that now seems best.
I'll go along.
No such sights to be shown, but to rejoice in splendor of mine own.
Of course, it's possible that in trying to give audiences a fresh, updated look at a classic, directors can end up with only a gimmick. Cerveris suggests a Romeo and Juliet with punk rocker Sid Vicious and his lover victim Nancy Spungen would, for example, be clearly going too far. For Peter Sellers, the issue is more subtle.
I think what was a difficulty with Romeo and Juliet was how flat and blank the sets were. So much less interesting than the acting. And that's because the sets had their only assignment to try and do Chicago in the 1930s. You know, and they needed one other assignment to be more complex. Most productions that I see that are updated are only updated. And that's just not enough. The greater level of artistry is to allow the audience to exist simultaneously in their own lifetime and in the lifetime of people who have lived on the earth before them.
It's not an easy assignment, and while Sellers' attempts have generally met critical acclaim, he's about to give up trying for that delicate balance between the old and the new. Preferring such contemporary works as his Nixon in China, Sellers says it's time to write more classics rather than continuing to update those we already have. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
I spent a tough week looking at Wagner again and trying to say, can I make anything of these gestures? You know, does there anything in my lifetime that is even remotely recognizable here? You know, that I could, from actual experience, put on stage in a way that it felt authentic? And late in my deliberations, the whole Jimmy Swaggart scandal broke. And I thought, well, now, this has a familiar ring.
Here's the intro for the George Lloyd piece. Cornish composer George Lloyd is a rarity, a modern-day composer who writes old-fashioned symphonies. His romantic, melodic orchestrations are loved by audiences and loathed by many critics. With 50 years' worth of those reactions in mind, Lloyd has reverted to making more recordings and fewer performances. That's why his Seventh Symphony, written in the late 1950s, is just getting its live premiere tonight at the Chicago Symphony's Orchestra Hall. As Marge Halperin reports, this performance is part of a resurgence of interest in Lloyd's work. And following is a tease for the George Lloyd piece. This is George Lloyd discussing reactions to his work and defending critics, himself against critics who say that he plays down to an audience.
people kept on, when they did hear it or did see the scores, they kept on abusing me and saying, you know. But they couldn't see that maybe it wasn't quite as much of an anachronism as they thought, because all of a sudden, a few years ago, when people got completely and utterly fed up with the lack of emotional appeal from the avant-garde, they've suddenly started realizing that they like hearing tunes and you know, and something that they can get hold of.
Host intro. There's a cultural revolution underway in Chicago. Not only are several new museums cropping up, but many of the city's established museums are undergoing major renovation and expansion. As Marge Halpern reports, it's a time for reassessing the role of cultural institutions in a major city. Most of Chicago's major museums were established around the turn of the century. Like so many of this city's landmarks, they were part of the construction boom after the Great Chicago Fire. As they hover around their centennial anniversaries, it's a logical time to take stock, and most of the museums are deciding it's time to update for the 21st century.
You have this tremendous feeling of excitement about, you know, all these things are expanding in different directions, and you know, on Michigan Avenue, on the lakefront, and in Oak Park, you know, the Frank Lloyd Wright Homer Studio. Not since the 1910s, with the building of the Field Museum of Natural History, and the 1920s, with the building of the Museum of Science and Industry, has Chicago put this kind of money and cultural energy into its institutions.
Christian Lane is curator of Design for Culture, an exhibition at Chicago's Merchandise Mart. For this show, he's compiled a list of a dozen exciting developments on Chicago's cultural scene, ranging from the relatively new Terra Museum of American Art to the long list of renovations at existing museums. There's the new wing of the Art Institute, along with renovation of some old galleries there. The Chicago Historical Society wrapped a classy new facade around the mismatched pair of buildings that in the past seems to have discouraged visitors. The Shedd Aquarium is building a creative oceanarium that will blend so perfectly with Chicago's lakefront that visitors may lose track of when they're inside and when they're outside. The Museum of Science and Industry's new Space Center is already a hit, drawing big crowds for its OmniMax Theater. And the Field Museum of Natural History is putting money both into an exterior facelift and a massive reorganization of its collection. The new Inside Ancient Egypt exhibit is a prime example of the Field's new direction. An extensive collection of Egyptian artifacts has been rearranged in the form of a simulated life-size tomb. Field President Sandy Boyd says this is an exciting new format for the old collection.
The reason we're building the tomb is to give a greater meaning to the original pieces. The original pieces stood alone, and frequently people had no idea what their meaning was to ancient Egyptian. Now that's pretty strong educational concept, trying to get people involved to think about, not just to look at these objects, but to think about what the meaning of them was then, what the significance of them is to us today, because we're not just talking about the past, we're talking about this in the context of the future.
And what better way to discover the treasures of ancient Egypt than the way archaeologists do it, by exploring the ruins? Exhibit developer Janet Kamian leads us down a narrow spiral staircase following a carefully constructed fake stone shaft that takes us into the burial chamber.
And what will happen here pretty soon is that these stones, which are less carefully done than the other stones, will turn into bedrock. See where it starts to be striated? So that you know now you're down inside of the bedrock. In here, there's going to be not a lot, because when you get down here, after all of this stuff and spiral staircases and burial shafts, well, the tomb robbers have been here. And, you know, 99% of the time, that's exactly what happened. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no information here, however. So we're going to hide some little this and that around in the corners. Oh, pot shard, an amulet, lidless canopic jar, that sort of thing. And they'll be kind of in the corners and stuff.
This type of interactive exhibit seems to be the key to the Museum of the 21st Century, and the concept is getting a new twist at the Chicago Historical Society. Chicagoans grew up with this museum's exhibit on pioneer life and with its high-quality but rather routine displays of Chicago furniture and ceramics. Thanks to a three-year, $15 million renovation, creative new gallery space is setting the stage for more lively exhibitions. There's the Chicago Street Exhibit, a multimedia show that creates the city streets at various points in history. It's putting into context the always popular displays of antique clothing, carriages, and memorabilia with the help of videotaped quotes.
Very, very bad driving down here. The people are wild. I mean, you're making turns out of second lanes. Oh, there goes one right now. Years ago, the policeman stood out there in the intersection. I'd blow the whistle, everybody would stop. Nobody would cross. I'm serious. And now, I could blow my head off. I could blow my head off and be angry. And they'll just look at me and laugh.
We wanted to give much more of a sense that history is a lively, ongoing activity. We wanted to present contemporary history, popular culture, as well as connoisseurship of beautiful objects.
Susan Tillett is Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Chicago Historical Society. She says too many people were scared away by the museum's old image. They'd taken the standard tour on a grade school field trip and never considered coming back. They're coming back now thanks to such pop culture themes as The Whole World is Watching, Inside and Outside the 1968 Democratic National Convention, and Say It Ain't So, Joe, the Black Sox scandal of 1919.
What I hope that people find when they walk into this museum is some connection with their life. And I don't think it has to be just high culture. I think people can have a view that history is very limited, that history is very scholarly or very elitist. And we really want to change that view. Sports is very much a part of Chicago's past and present. And the 1919 World Series, when the White Sox threw the games and lost to the Chicago Reds, is a very famous incident, not only in Chicago history, but in American history. It shows up not only in Eight Men Out, it shows up in The Great Gatsby and all kinds of literature. It's one of those things, it's kind of those incidents where America symbolically lost its innocence.
Reassessing the role of museums in our lives is more than a Chicago obsession. It's happening across the country and in Europe, too. While their cultural history stretches back farther than ours, curator Christian Lane suggests our cultural futures are parallel. He's looking forward to a wide-reaching cultural boom of which Chicago is only a small part.
The differences are simply in our lifestyle, that we will be having more time on our hands as a society to do more cultural things, to have more cultural pursuits. Machines are doing the work for us. We've really entered a post-industrial phase of our society. And that really, really means that we will have more time on our hands to really make an effort to understand more important things that are on a higher level, a higher cultural level, definitely.
It's the goal many of our nation's museums are now striving to reach, and the only thing that might stand in the way is the shrinking pool of funds for such ambitious projects. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Here's your tease cut. This is architecture critic and curator Christian Lane. Christian as in C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N-L-A-N-E. He is curator of Design for Culture, an exhibition at Chicago's Merchandise Mart, now as an overview of museum developments. Here he's talking about how the many museums in Chicago and elsewhere are updating for new modern audiences.
They don't want simply to show you. There's an effort there to engage you, to bring you into the whole idea and make you part of the cultural experience. I think that's a very good thing.
Host intro. Cornish composer George Lloyd is a rarity, a modern-day composer who writes old-fashioned symphonies. His romantic, melodic orchestrations are loved by audiences and loathed by many critics. With 50 years' worth of those reactions in mind, Lloyd has reverted to making more recordings and fewer performances. That's why his Seventh Symphony, written in the late 1950s, is just getting its live premiere tonight at the Chicago Symphony's Orchestra Hall. As Marge Halpern reports, this performance is part of a resurgence of interest in Lloyd's work. A memorable tune, a flash of brass, the upbeat ending. These are the hallmarks of George Lloyd's symphonies, the qualities that win him applause from audiences and darts from critics and academicians. Lloyd was a commercial success at the start of his career. His first opera, produced in 1934 when he was 21, was quickly followed by a second. Though just as his career was taking off, so was World War II. Lloyd enlisted with the Royal Marines, and a tour of duty in the Arctic left him badly shell-shocked and unable to write. When he returned to music, Lloyd was treated like an anachronism. Producers weren't interested in what the Chicago Symphony's artist-in-residence, John Coriano, now calls Lloyd's romantic style. Coriano admires Lloyd's ambitious goals and his ability to realize them.
Craft is immaculate here. I mean, he really does know how to write the piece. He does know how to set it for orchestra. He does know how to recapitulate and develop and do all the things that make music come alive. Now, whether I happen to like it more than another piece or less than another piece is a secondary thing. That's very subjective. But I can tell you as a professional composer that Lloyd is a wonderful symphonist.
Lloyd's Seventh Symphony captures those qualities. This first movement is typically upbeat, a lively dance for the goddess Proserpine, who spent 6 months a year on Earth and six in the underworld. While the first movement represents the joyous time on Earth, it's the more somber second movement that may best show off Lloyd's craft. Anyone who wants to know how his music should be played, Lloyd says, should listen to this movement.
There are a tremendous number of very small variations of tempo, a lot of rubato. Now, my music goes absolutely dead if you play it in a square sort of way. Of course, it's a bit of a battle because orchestras nowadays, symphony orchestras at any rate, have got so into the habit of playing everything in a very bangy, straight, square sort of a way that one has to teach them now, actually, to sing a phrase so that there are these little tiny variations. I wrote it with enormous difficulty, and after I'd written it, I was very ill. I was carted off to a hospital, and they just didn't know what was the matter with me. I had fevers and delusions and heaven knows what. And I just wanted to die. That was all there was about it. I wanted to die. And I could never make out, my mind whether I wanted to die because I'd written this symphony or I wrote the symphony because I wanted to die, you see. So, but the thing is that I tacked on the idea of the Proserpine legend, which just suited my thoughts at the time.
Lloyd wasn't pleased with the Seventh Symphony when he was through. It sat in a drawer for 16 years before he was convinced it should be heard. He was worried about its tragic ending and didn't expect audiences to like the work any more than he did. He was wrong. It was one of his best-selling recordings on England's Conifer label. But Lloyd left the depressing themes behind and moved on to the brighter, more optimistic work his critics despise but his audiences love.
My severest critics, the ones who want to pour scorn on what I do, they say, oh, the fellow, he just writes down for the public. You know, he writes for brass and drums and tunes and rhythms and all that sort of thing. And he's writing down to the taste of the public. But that's entirely wrong, because my tastes are very largely the same as most of the people in the public. I like tunes, I like brass, I like drums, I like all these things, you see. So that's the reason why I write for them.
That's not to say that Lloyd would apologize for writing what the public likes. At a meeting once with fellow composers, Lloyd stood up to urge them to get back in touch with their audiences, and he was shouted down. Lloyd is pleased that his audiences can relate to his music. His symphony is one of the few new works on the Chicago Symphony schedule this year that appeals to new music skeptic Richard Oldberg, French horn player with the CSO.
You see, the point is that the audience is there voluntarily. And it seems to me that if you expect them to part with their money and sit there and take what you have to say seriously, that you must speak their language and say something that not only they can understand, but that they will appreciate.
The CSO's management is perhaps more flexible. While tonight's performance demonstrates that they won't be swayed by critics' complaints about Lloyd's common denominators, neither will they agree with Oldberg's contention that there's no room for the avant-garde. John Croiano is hoping to do away with that sort of exclusivity as well.
All kinds of music can exist at the same time in a healthy environment. We have people still writing serial music and 12-tone music, and we have people like George Lloyd writing their music, and minimalists, and all sorts of other ists. All of this together in the same kind of bubbling cauldron of 20th century music is a very good thing, and 25 years from now we'll find the great pieces of that are happening right now, and we'll know what they are. Right now we should just listen to them.
Apparently, the listening public is willing to give George Lloyd a respected place in the mix of 20th century music, judging from the lively sales of Lloyd's recordings and enthusiastic audiences at the few public performances of his works. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. Chicago is known for its rough-and-tumble politics, and power struggles here are a common occurrence. But on the dance stage?
Well, dance is a very political event. The dance scene in Chicago is always a very emotional scene, always has been. And any time that anything is done, there's always going to be factionalism. It's just a fact of life in Chicago.
Larry Long is a good person to chronicle that history. For much of it, he's worked alongside Chicago's grand dame of dance, Ruth Page. He's now associate director of Her Nutcracker.
Parents, you could react to this a little bit. Look what he's doing.
This is Robert Weiss putting the finishing touches on his Nutcracker before its first performances over the Thanksgiving weekend. He's using George Balanchine's 1954 choreography, which established the Nutcracker as a Christmas tradition. Weiss rode into Chicago with the Pennsylvania and Milwaukee Ballet's brash marketing plan, billing theirs as the only Nutcracker in town faithful to the original classic. Not surprisingly, Larry Long takes offense at that.
Balanchine's Nutcracker was first in America on a large scale and has gone on the longest, and so there's a certain cachet in that. But the real Nutcracker was done by Petipa in Russia in 1890 something. Any Nutcracker since then is a new Nutcracker.
And now both companies are claiming to be the most true to that original ballet. Weiss was quoted in a Milwaukee newspaper as saying, Chicago deserves a real Nutcracker. A quote he now says he's sorry made it to Chicago.
For me, there's no competition between anybody. I mean, and there's no, there are no disparate elements. I wish Chicago to have a big success. I'd like Chicago to become a big dance town, and I think it's about time that that happens. It's the third largest city in the country, I believe. There should be a lot more ballet going on in Chicago than there is. The public just needs to be built up, that's all.
But having laid down the gauntlet, Weiss finds himself in the middle of a fight, and not entirely without his own contributions. The matter is complicated by the fact that the Chicago dance audience may well be ripe for the picking. Chicago has not supported its own ballet company for years, perhaps not since Ruth Page's own company disbanded in the early 1970s. The new Ballet Chicago Company is still marking out its territory, and many of its members are in the Ruth Page production, which is cast through open auditions. Weiss now says he regrets once referring to Page's all-star cast as a pickup company, but he still can't resist touting his own tight team.
We have some of the best talent in the country in our principal ranks. We don't need to bring in guest artists because we have stars of our own. I've worked with the principal dancers in the company for 6 years, and I think we have a vision about how we want to see our dancers look, and that having worked with when you work with the dancer for 6 years, they develop in a special way.
Larry Long has an answer to that, too, though he's not the type to label Weiss a young upstart, as he might well want to do.
Seeing a company is kind of like eating, you know, tasting. Eat it, taste it, and see whether you like it or not. See whether it sounds like it's looks like it's a pickup company. That would be like saying, well, Lyric Opera is a pickup opera company because they bring in stars for each of the operas. They don't live here. They're not there the whole time, whole year round. It's a ridiculous kind of assumption.
So what is it about the Sugar Plum Fairy that makes everyone so possessive? New choreography is welcome for many ballets, but when it comes to the Nutcracker, it's hard to find anyone unbiased, not even a critic. Nancy Goldner writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer and suggests that the first Nutcracker we see as a child is engraved in our minds as the Nutcracker. The first one she saw was the Balanchine choreography, now staged by the Pennsylvania and Milwaukee Ballet. Though Goldner's never seen Ruth Page's Nutcracker, she assumes it can't be as good.
Ruth Page is a choreographer. I know she's terribly important to dance in Chicago. But as a choreographer, you know, she's in a different league than Balanchine, and it's silly to pretend otherwise when it comes to Balanchine's choreography. And you know, everybody, it's by consensus that his Nutcracker is just it's a beautiful thing. It strikes me as being silly just for someone to hold on to their old thing when they have, you know, something that's so beautiful in the offing.
The Pennsylvania and Milwaukee version is spectacular. Updated last year, it's filled with such special effects as a Christmas tree that grows to 30 feet, 250 pounds of gently falling snow, and a golden flying boat that carries young Clara and her prince off into the sunset at the end of the production. The Ruth Page Ballet is beautifully staged, with such careful costuming that in the family Christmas party scene, mothers' and daughters' dresses are coordinated. But its special effects haven't been recently updated. What's a town to do with two Nutcrackers? Instead of choosing up sides, both Robert Weiss and Larry Long suggest true fans will see them both.
I hate this idea of competition. I hate the idea that one has to say mine is better. It seems to me very juvenile. It's like two children kind of on the street, you know, saying my father can do this and your father can't. It seems so unnecessary. There's room in Chicago for two Nutcrackers.
Seeing both productions is easy. Taking the role of a Thanksgiving Nutcracker, the Pennsylvania and Milwaukee Ballet closes its production this weekend, while the Ruth Page Ballet will run through the month of December. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.